This is Mark McNeese, and you're listening to One Thing or Another, Interviews and Conversations. Welcome to the podcast. This is your host, Mark, and today I'm happy to have on Professor Lucas Hildebrandt. He lives in Los Angeles and teaches film and media, visual and queer studies at the University of California, Irvine. He's written on the pleasures and politics of video bootlegging, the mediations of queer memory, and the ambiguities of experimental documentary. And today we're going to be talking about his newest book, which is The Bars Are Ours. Before we start, tell us a little bit about yourself, Lucas.
So
your career and your life.
Yeah, so I'm based in Los Angeles now, but I grew up in South Dakota and lived in Minneapolis and New York, both as a student and adult prior to coming to LA. And so each of these places I've lived has really shaped my understanding of what queer life was, queer community, and really the centrality of bars in terms of shaping how one learns to be gay, at least for my generation.
Were you a bar goer early on? Like as soon as you could legally go to a bar, did you start going to bars?
Yes. And primarily, initially, mostly for dancing. I would say more than for the drinking early on. But that was really, for me, sort of coming out into the world, but also moving to a city was very much about having access to the worlds that nightlife makes possible and the kind of euphoria of dancing and being in a crowd and exploring sort of other life possibilities, particularly by night.
Now, part of the book's description, it says gay bars have operated as the most visible institutions of the LGBTQ+ community in the United States for the better part of a century, from before gay liberation until after their assumed obsolescence. It made me think of when I was growing up. I grew up in Elkhart, Indiana, which was a small town adjacent to South Bend, where Notre Dame is. And I do remember there being one gay bar in South Bend. Mm-hmm. And back in the 70s, it was dark. You didn't know it was a gay bar unless you were told. That's just coming into my mind right now, because it seems like, and it's part of your book too, just the whole history and the changes that it's all gone through. You know, I wasn't even really aware of gay bars until I moved to LA in the early 80s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so one of the things that's really interesting, particularly in earlier bar history, is this sense of discovery and the sense of knowing of the bars, knowing how to find the bars, is really a form of knowledge. And it marks you sort of coming into a public awareness or an awareness of a gay public world or a public life or an accessible community in a way that's different than it would be for straight people growing up. Bars mean, I think, something totally different for queer people.
Oh, absolutely. Now, what drew you to this as a topic? Because your book is a pretty big undertaking, both in the research that you did and the travel and everything else. What made you want to commit that much to this particular topic?
So my first book was based on my dissertation, which was written about videotape effectively at the moment when it was being declared dead and obsolete. And I was really interested in that project with writing about a cultural form that had been so transformative for how we understood film, television, and how we accessed it, but that had really been overlooked because it had been so pervasive. And as I was finishing that project, it occurred to me that there really wasn't a book that offered an ambitious and panoramic account of gay bars during the period when they were most common. And it seemed like a book that should exist. And it was also this moment when people were beginning to predict the death of the gay bar as a community institution and as a cultural form. And so it seemed like a really fascinating project to try to take on in that moment. And because it didn't exist, that's what really interested me. But also, I knew that it was an ambitious project. It was bigger than anything I'd ever done before. And I actually really liked that about it. And going into it, it took several years to figure out what the scale of it would be, how to even begin to research, and how to conceptualize the structure of it.
Now, I think you wrote that it took about 15 years.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you traveled? And what was that? What was that whole thing? I'm not a fan of the word process, but what was that process like to go from this idea you have to a densely packed finished book?
Well, the research inevitably happens in ebbs and flows because I am also a full-time faculty member, which means I'm doing teaching and administration. But during summers, during breaks, during sabbaticals, I would basically camp out during summers at the One Archive in Los Angeles, which is the largest gay and lesbian archive in the world. And I would just go through whatever collections they'd had. So initially I was looking at any collection I could identify as being related to bar history. And early on, that was often things like matchbook collections or party flyer collections, which were really fascinating objects and have great images, but there's not enough text and there's not enough narrative to build out what the context was or to really tell a story from that. So the next stage was really going through the national and local gay press as far as I could and paging through decades of Gay Community News, Bay Area Reporter, The Advocate, New York Native, different publications. And so I was doing that in Los Angeles, but I also, when I had the opportunity for travel, whether it's for a conference or for a more sustained research trip, I would look up any local collections I could find. So, and it was a mix of very much community-based collections that were not institutionalized, as well as special collections at public libraries or at universities that were a little bit more developed in terms of archival practice. But there was a really wide spectrum of approaches to archiving and collecting this history. But I had a strong sense wherever I went that there was a really core commitment on the part of the archivists for the need to document this history and a real hunger for their collections to be used by historians to tell these local and national stories.
Were there things that surprised you?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that surprised me was that drag is a relatively recent staple of the gay bar. And it really only emerges as a gay bar culture in the mid to late 1960s and becomes more central in the 1970s and after. It was something that I had assumed had always been part of gay bar culture. But the research, particularly in Kansas City, which was a city I didn't necessarily assume would be in the book, and I hadn't initially imagined would be where I talk about drag, but Kansas City really allowed me to understand the emergence of gay bar drag as distinct from theatrical traditions of female impersonation. So what we see in Kansas City is that there were two venues only a block apart, owned by the same person with much of the same talent, but they served different audiences. And what the performances meant different things. So one was a female impersonation lounge in a more theatrical tradition, and that was frequented by straight audiences, and it was not assumed to be a gay venue. Next door, or the next block over, the Colony Bar was an avowedly gay bar, and they had drag performances there for a gay audience. And so the cultural form meant different things in different contexts, but the audience also had a different relationship to the performance and to the queens. And so Kansas City really helped me understand the emergence of that distinction, but also it helped clarify what counts as a gay bar and what does not.
That's fascinating. And it just popped into my head too, that there might be people who mistake cross-dressing for drag. It's not the same thing, because I was immediately thought of the Molly houses in England, you know, but that wasn't drag. That was either transgender people or cross-dressing. And I don't know if I'm making any sense with that, but
yeah.
But
so I mean, also the language changes at different periods. And so in the 1960s, the word drag queen was often used for performers, but it was also used for trans women. It could be used for cross dressers. It was used very expansively, and we've eventually developed more precise language, but also each generation refines the preferred terms. And so as a concept, I think there wasn't culturally the same recognition that those are different things that we have now.
Now, you stated in the preference that you approached gay bars as a medium, a form that gives structure to social actions and worldviews. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah. So my
training, and explain it.
Yeah. So my training and my teaching is in film and media studies. So I'm trained to think about film, television, video, both in terms of how they have certain conventions of representation, but they also have certain norms and certain technological affordances. You can do certain things with film, and there's other things you can't do with film, but certain conventions emerge out of that. And I was trying to apply those lessons to thinking about gay bars, in that they are physical structures and they have certain norms, some of which are regulated by liquor licensing or zoning. But within that structure, we see the emergence of different subcultures, whether it's leather or drag or dancing and disco. But we also understand that they become the place to find community. They become a place for people to learn the norms of gay culture and gay vernacular, and learn sort of the norms of how to become gay, but how to also define what kind of gay person they are. They're also the site where we see most visibly political organizing and community critique. So it's through gay bars that we begin to address racism and discrimination within the gay community, whether it's about discriminatory door policies or differential service by the staff, depending on someone's race or gender. But we also see that bars become really central to the debates around gentrification, about the development of gay neighborhoods, but also the de-gaying of historically gay neighborhoods and the ways in which it exposes certain classed tensions between who is part of the community and who has the right to occupy public space, and what rights afford to homeowners and property owners versus the rights of people who are part of the community but maybe don't live in a neighborhood. So what right do they have to go to a gay neighborhood, to occupy space on the street, to have access to a sense of a public and a community?
Did you have difficulty finding people who maintain archives? Because like you said, a lot of them aren't, I mean, it just could be just somebody's personal home who has, you know, 50 years worth of magazine covers or something like that. How did you go about finding the archival material that you were looking for?
So it begins with, I mean, very simply, sort of it began with Google searches, and then I would find websites that would collate listings of different collections. Some of them have websites, some of them don't have websites, some of them don't have email, some of them have only a phone number. And it's really a process of trying to figure out what exists where and what's accessible, and just really sort of as I traveled or sort of planned travel, trying to find what existed. And because I've been working on the project for so long, there are more collections now than there were when I started, and more things are searchable online. So there's more digitized collections, but there's also been a really remarkable increase in efforts to document local histories, whether it's at the city level or state level. There's a lot of history projects and community-based self-documentation that's happening. So we see either web-based projects or we see mapping projects using new technologies around like Google Maps and other kinds of mapping technologies to locate where bars were. We see increasing efforts at community-based oral histories to record those stories that maybe weren't otherwise told or preserved. So there's been a really remarkable explosion and expansion of what community-based history and what archival collecting looks like. And increasingly, it's findable on the internet. But when I was starting out, it really was trial and error. And sometimes it was hard to determine how robust a collection would be. And honestly, you never really know until you're there and start looking through things. But it's really often about talking to the archivists themselves, and they know their collections better than a keyword search on the online or on the database is going to find. And so it's really also about developing a relationship with the archivists, and they can guide you to what they have. And sometimes what they have isn't necessarily what I was looking for, or what they thought I was looking for isn't necessarily what I was looking for, but it becomes part of the process of figuring out sort of what has been documented and what cities allowed me to tell which parts of the history of gay bars.
And on the history of gay bars, do you think that they are obsolete or becoming obsolete? That seems to be a lot of people think that. I'm not sure what to make of it. Here where I live, there used to be three large gay venues, and they're all gone. And the last one was torn down about a year and a half ago and turned into a parking lot. Right. So I'm not sure. What do you think about that?
So my answer is complex. So on the one hand, yes, the statistical number of gay bars has certainly diminished in the last 10, 20 years. That's undeniable. What we've seen is that the social role of gay bars has shifted as people have other ways to find community or find sexual partners or to explore coming out. And particularly as people come out younger, oftentimes before drinking age or going out age, the gay bar isn't the way into a community in the way that it was decades ago. That said, I still, when I go out in different cities, the gay bar is packed with people. So I would say that although the number has diminished, the culture has not ended. And what we're seeing, and I've heard this both in Los Angeles and in other cities, is that we're seeing a post-COVID renewal, so that we're not seeing perhaps the same number of bars opening that we lost, but we're beginning to see new bars open. And oftentimes they're imagining a more inclusive vision of what a gay bar could be and who it serves. They mm-hmm. also imagining sort of different things for a newer generation that wants different things from their nightlife. But I think one of the things that we understood during COVID and during the lockdown is the real necessity of being in community and having public spaces. And I think part of this renewal that we're seeing, as well as sort of seemingly a broader attention to gay bar history and attention to reclaiming the significance of gay bars, is in part because we understood what we were losing when we couldn't go out.
That's an really interesting perspective. I just have a couple more questions. This is a scholarly work. This is not, you know, it's the kind of thing that I just love and can take my time reading. But who is your intended audience?
So I was asked this fairly early on, and my answer was queer people. So straight people are welcome to read it, but it's not for them. They weren't my imagined audience. But it was, I am a scholar and there is a lot of research. So it was important to me that it be a rigorous account, and that I do the homework, that I do the historical research. But I also always felt that a book about gay bars should not be boring. That like, unless it found a way to bring a kind of vitality and life and readability to this history, it shouldn't exist. And so I've really tried to make it as accessible and dynamic and readable of a history as possible. And so it's really trying to do both the scholarly research, but also have a kind of levity and life and hopefully emotional impact that makes it resonate for readers beyond academia. I didn't want it
I find it absorbing, and I'm a slow reader at this point in my life, so I can spend the next year reading it, which is nice to know. I just think it's a fascinating book. And now that it's out, as somebody who puts out this sort of book, you know, what's next for you? Do you tour? What do you do now? I know you're doing an event with the Stonewall Museum in Fort Lauderdale because I registered for that, but.
Yeah. So there are some public events, and I've particularly prioritized doing events in the cities where I did research and the cities I write about, as well as places I did research. So I did research at the Stonewall National Museum Archive and Library, and so I was very happy to do an event with them. So part of it is I want the book to have a life, and in particular, sort of going to the cities that I write about, so that it's not only a New York, San Francisco, LA account, but that it recognizes and sort of I'm part of conversations in Kansas City, in Omaha, in Houston, in Boston, in Florida. So that's really important to me. And at this point, I'm also sort of learning, because the book just came out, so I'm also really interested to see what kinds of audiences it reaches. One never knows when one's writing. And sort of living with, I've lived with this book for 15 years, so I'm really interested in to see to what extent it speaks to audiences beyond academia, but also beyond sort of my little sort of hermit hole of being a writer. So it's been really exciting to see that it does seem to speak to people and that people are really interested in this history.
There is there is a review in the New York Times. I read that.
Yes.
Yeah. By Harry Neff. That was nice. And I think it's a spectacular book. So I'm really delighted that you took the time to talk to me about it. And I certainly will let everybody know that this is something, you know, that they should be looking into and getting and reading, especially if you're somebody like me who likes that sort of, I don't even know how to express it, but I had said dense. It's a really, there's a lot there to unpack, and I enjoy that.
Yeah. Well, for me, part of the process of writing it is that I felt that it's really often in the details that you get a sense of a place or that this history comes alive. And so there's a lot of information, but there's a lot of details. And I really try to create a history that has the kind of texture that you can almost feel or remember, even if you never went to these bars, through those details. And that was really a strategic thing. And I'm really glad to hear that you're a slow reader, because I think the book is intended to be something that you sit with and that you don't just burn through, but that you actually sort of indulge in a kind of joy of reading, hopefully, and sort of and maybe ruminating as you read it. So it doesn't, you know, although I hope it's readable, I also hope people take pleasure.
It's very readable.
Yeah. And the other question about who is the audience. So one of the things that I thought was really important is that the book speak across generations. So I think there's audiences for whom the book will be very nostalgic. So people who are older, who have gone to bars, and have very strong memories of them, but maybe they don't go out as much as they used to anymore. There's also young people who bars may not be their primary reference for what queer life looks like. And I needed to find a way to sort of speak to sort of why bars mattered and what they meant to people, for people who are younger or who maybe didn't have access to them. And one of the things I learned in doing the research is that there are, you know, sort of there's these cyclical generational tensions and redefinitions of community, of politics, of identity, but also bars and parties themselves.
Well, you succeeded spectacularly, in my opinion.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to enjoying this for a long time to come, because I love those details. I love learning things I didn't know and going into these places with you that you write about. Thank you so much again for this.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure talking.
You're welcome. And I'll send you the link as soon as I share it. And, you know, a lot of my readers are older people who are going to identify with this as part of their own history. So I really appreciate that.
Well, and that's one of the challenges, is that I was writing about bars that I've never been to because they've closed, but that potentially people who read the book had strong experiences of. So I had to find a way to capture a spirit of a place I've never been to. And that's one of the challenges with the book.
Thank you again. And you have a wonderful rest of your day. And I look forward to hearing you with the Stonewall Museum tomorrow night.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to One Thing or Another. Interviews and Conversations with your host, Mark McNeese, brought to you by Mademark Publishing. Find us on iTunes, Amazon, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to your favorite podcasts.